One of the ways to make a road trip fun is to take enough time to really enjoy the journey rather than rushing to your next destination. Jane and Michael Stern are back with us today on Travel with Rick Steves with tips for turning your next interstate drive into a road food pilgrimage. They're the experts at finding the best regional food specialties all across the USA, at neighborhood places the locals know are well worth a detour off the interstate. Hey, I was just wondering as I was reading through your book, what about bowling alley eateries?
Well, there are a few great ones. I mean, in Tripp, South Dakota? It's the Tripp Sports Bowl. And it's sure enough, you dine with a view of the bowling alleys. There aren't that many. Let's face it, most bowling alleys do not have excellent food. The Tripp Sports Bowl had, like, good homemade South Dakota food.
But, you know, if you're in an area like Rhode Island or Connecticut that has a very heavy Italian population, if you see a bocce club or a social club, yep, they often have dinners open to the public. Same with VFW halls, yep, out in the sticks.
Oh, that's a good tip, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Church pierogi suppers in Pittsburgh.
Oh, yeah, the Norwegian Club pancake breakfast is my favorite in my town. So you're walking through, you're driving through a town and you see a sign that the Norwegian Club's going to have their pancake breakfast. Boy,
exactly.
That would be. And it's always a great scene. It's got that conviviality, and you know grandma knows how to make the right pancakes.
And when people bring food to a breakfast like that, they show off. They do
That's
their
right.
best.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're fantasizing about road food all across the United States with the gurus of road food, Jane and Michael Stern. Their website is roadfood.com. And Jane and Michael, one thing that fascinates me is you can think clam chowder, and you can think, yes, that's great clam chowder, but clam chowder is different dishes in different parts of the country. You got New England, you got Oregon Coast, and so on. And in fact, you list your top clam chowders
Rhode
in the book.
Rhode Island.
Talk about the regional, for instance, what's a classic clam chowder on the East Coast compared to one on the West Coast?
Well, it depends on what part of the East Coast you're talking about. In New England, it's a kind of a creamy white clam chowder. Then there's Manhattan clam chowder, which is basically vegetable soup with clams in
right,
it.
Right, tomato based.
Ah, okay. And then there's Rhode Island style chowder, which is kind of tomato, creamy, sort of a cross between the
what?
Two of them. Then no, wait.
You're wrong.
No,
I'm it's a clear broth.
No, that's South Coast clam chowder is the clear broth. And then out as you know, Rick, in the Pacific Northwest, clam chowder is usually very thick.
It's potato. Tends
to have a lot of
almost.
Pork in it. And yeah. I mean you could stand a spoon in it.
Yeah. It's a high-risk kind of thing to order. It can be great or it can really be disappointing.
Yeah, I tend to get a little chauvinistic because I love Rhode Island, Connecticut clam chowder.
Okay, well, I'll keep an eye on that. And oysters are the same way. I mean, you can like oysters in the Carolinas. They're a lot different than Chesapeake Bay or the... I love the way you described the pan-roasted oysters in the oyster bar at Grand Central Station.
Grand Central Station is one of those places where they get oysters from all over the country and indeed the world. I mean, they're not cheap, but if you want to really sample oysters, that is a terrific place to go. And a real taste of New York.
And also, just make sure when you get Rocky Mountain oysters, you know what you're getting, because them ain't oysters.
No.
No.
These are testicles of what? Bull testicles.
Sheep. Sheeps or bulls, generally.
Sheep or bulls.
There are rooster fries.
And there are rooster fries as well.
In fact, in Montana, there's...
Rooster fries? Little rooster
they're very
balls?
Little. Mm-hmm. And there's the testicle festival. Seriously.
Yeah.
Once a year in Montana.
And that would be mostly sheep and bulls.
Right. And actually at the testicle festival, there's a taste like chicken contest.
Do these Rocky Mountain oysters, do they actually taste good? No.
You know, it's really, I mean,
all I can think of is that great Baxter Black poem, the cowboy poet who wrote an ode to Rocky Mountain oysters, kind of sums it up, if you know.
No, they're not. I mean, most of them are fried enough, so it's sort of like chitlins that what you taste
meat.
Is the fried part. The actual meat inside is almost undiscernible.
Whoever ate the first raw oyster, I mean, talk about a disgusting thing. I mean, a real oyster, a sea oyster from the sea. So what we find disgusting in Oklahoma is... you know, absolute paradise in New England.
Now, when you think about oysters from the sea, this is something that's fascinating to me because it takes, for a lot of people, it takes a lot of nerve to eat a raw oyster. But once you do it, it's a special nirvana, I think. And I don't think of it quite as road food, but are you guys aficionados of good raw oysters?
I love raw oysters. I mean, I'm one of those people who really thinks if I could eat all I wanted, I would just never stop.
So what is your tip on appreciating the fine differences? Because you can, in a good oyster place, you've got six or eight different bays that they came from. Why bother?
Actually, I've seen in the Oyster Bar in New York, they have, I think, 25 or 30.
Yeah, and that's really a matter of taste. I mean, generally speaking, I personally prefer like the really small ones, like the Yakina Bays. I mean, to me, when they get too big, they're slightly gross. You know, like a big mouthful of raw oyster is too much raw oyster for me.
It's like a cherry stone clam compared to a quahog clam.
Right.
It's like biting one in half. You just don't want to do that.
No. Uh-uh. It should slide right down.
And you should be thinking about the sea as you enjoy it. It almost lets me know that I had some sort of a primeval existence as a mollusk or something like that. I don't know.
Well, we all did.
I guess we did. It takes me way, way back.
We started as one-cell creatures in the big brine.
All right. We're getting philosophical here, talking about road food with Jane and Michael Stern. Jane and Michael, you talk about destination desserts. I'm not necessarily one to drive a long way for a great maple cream pie. Convince me it's worth it.
Well, I just assume you didn't drive all the way from Seattle because we're much closer to right. There'll be more for us.
Okay.
About a great maple cream pie, what makes it good is its simplicity. I mean, you know, as much as I like a complicated pie with chocolate chips and peanuts and blah blah blah, there's something. I mean, a maple cream pie is basically just a cream pie flavored with maple, and if it's real cream, like good heavy farm cream and pure maple, there's something. It's significant, and it's, you know, it's a significant piece of food, but it's very light. It's almost ethereal.
My favorite pie, you never see it out of Iowa, and that's sour cream raisin pie, which is a sour cream base with raisins in a pie crust with a giant fluffy meringue on the top. And it's one of the great, absolutely great pies. Also, I love sweet potato pie.
Well, the great thing about a sour cream raisin pie is the balance, because there's that slight sourness of the cream and the sweetness of the raisins and the custard. I mean, that to me is actually the secret of great dessert. That's why rhubarb, I think, makes such a terrific pie.
So when you guys go into a restaurant, do you order different stuff and split it all and then share your notes? What's the process?
We usually order the whole menu, I hate to say.
We order as much as humanly possible and split it and taste it. And yes.
And trick number 45 is I always have a little hefty bag in my purse, because in a little restaurant, a small-town restaurant, you don't want to insult the waitress or the chef by leaving tons of food. So I just sort of scoop it into.
You actually dump it out and then take it away now, so they don't know you didn't eat it.
Here's where it backfired. We went to a barbecue rib place, and I put all the rib bones in my purse. We went to a lobster place. I put the entire shell in my
purse.
Oyster
shells wouldn't work either.
Right.
Oh,
so,
no.
So, you know, you get a pretty nutty look if you don't leave some of it behind.
Yeah, I guess. But the point is you want to sample as many things on the menu as you can when you go into a restaurant.
Well, I think as many things that are meaningful. You know, the thing is if you're in barbecue country, you maybe don't need to sample the oatmeal.
Right.
You know, you want to taste what that restaurant's going to do best.
Is there anything that you just don't like? What don't you like?
Chitlins.
Well, that's not many people probably like chitlins.
And
but
chitlins steamed in vinegar is even worse than fried chitlins.
Have you ever had to eat something just because the cook really wanted you to eat it and you just thought, oh, please, I don't want to go
Well,
there.
A pig snout, which Michael actually liked very much. I was thinking
well,
that
it's
it
not
was
like a nose on a plate. I mean, it's, it's like, you know, it's like shaved and stuff. So you don't see it as a pig snout any more than you see the
you
know, sandwiches in St. Louis.
On the other hand, pig's ears do look like ears a little bit.
God,
they do.
They
and
really
they're
do.
And they're kind of, I had to sort of take a deep breath before I bit into a pig's ear. I was expecting it to be sort of tough and gristly.
No.
And in fact, it's cooked long enough that it's really tender.
Where would you find pig's ears in the United States?
St. Louis.
St. Louis, for some reason, I mean, it has great barbecue like so many Midwestern cities, but for some reason, it has a lot of weird barbecue things like snoots or snouts.
Yeah. Is it a carrier for the barbecue sauce, or is it actually the flavor of the pig's ear that people go for?
Well, actually, I've been served pig's ears without sauce, just a pig ear with lettuce between two pieces of white bread.
Yeah.
And then brain sandwiches in St. Louis at all the bars, which are pretty weird.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're bouncing all over the place from maple cream pie to brain sandwiches. We're talking to the gurus of road food, Jane and Michael Stern. Their book is Road Food, and their website is roadfood.com. Jane and Michael, if you were like the governor of a state, what would you name as the state beverage, the state dessert, the official food? Not of all 50 states, but tell me a few states where you really would find that local people are proud of this and, you know, just like we have state birds or state flowers and so on.
Well, there are states that have official state foods. Texas has chili. Rhode Island has an official state drink, which is coffee milk, kind of like chocolate milk, but it's coffee flavored. Utah has an official state snack food, which is Jell-O.
Jell-O in Utah.
Jell-O in Utah. And Indiana has an official state drink, which is, you'll never guess this, water.
What's the story about that?
This is a governor with very little imagination.
No, it's significant because Indiana used to be known, and maybe still is, for its the healthful benefits of its spring water.
And Pluto water.
And Pluto water as
which
well.
Which is a purge.
And Idaho would be potatoes.
Idaho would be potatoes, blueberry pie in Maine.
Who was Fluffernutter?
Oh, in Massachusetts, cranberries are one of the official state foods of Massachusetts, but the state legislature battled for weeks many years ago about whether they ought to make Fluffernutter an official state food. You know, Fluffernutter is marshmallow fluff and peanut butter on white bread.
I don't know why.
The move was finally defeated because they felt it was just not the way they wanted to represent Massachusetts, culinarily speaking.
What are you excited about now for your work? I know that your website is very lively, and it seems like you've got as much energy as ever. What haven't you done? What do you want to do more of? What do you see in the next couple of years in your road food work?
We need to go to Hawaii and eat more plate lunch. You know, that's a big deal in Hawaii, plate lunch, and we haven't done enough of that.
And I've never been to Alaska.
Yes.
Michael hasn't either.
We live in a 48-state country.
We're the contiguous Sterns.
I got to Alaska for my first time in my life just this year and went with a local recommendation for a crab shack and had this incredible king crab meal. And grown up on crab, and I never had it quite like that. And that
really are. You'll have to tell us about this.
Yeah, I will before you go up there. Another question. I have this sense that as mass food, corporate chain restaurants and so on are rising and a lot of the funky places are having a struggle to survive, ethnic eateries are kind of on the rise and give us that same sort of magic regional specialty and conviviality and passion for food. Talk a little bit about the new dimension of ethnic eateries in the sense of road food.
Well, when we started looking for road food, you could only find Mexican food really along the border and in Texas. I mean, or maybe some really bad Mexican food in other cities. Now, you know, there is some terrific Mexican food. I mean, Mexican food from Oaxaca, from Sonora. I mean, different styles of Mexican food around the country.
We just did a wonderful tour in Tucson of Sonoran hot dogs.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Which is only found in this one particular neighborhood of Tucson. And they're very unique.
And in Los Angeles, they have like taco truck tours.
And I think that what's significant about the rise of these ethnic foods is that they do what any great road food restaurant does, which is to reflect the community. Any great restaurant, in our book anyway, is part of the culture of where it is. And obviously, you know, a Vietnamese restaurant in Minneapolis or, you know, a Mexican restaurant in Chicago is there because there's a clientele that really wants it and treasures it as part of their identity. And that's what makes a good restaurant.
Reflecting the community. That is so in keeping with where we're going politically in our country and everything. We are morphing and evolving and changing, and the country is becoming more diverse, and so is the road food.
But you know, some of the regional road food or ethnic road food really kind of stayed here and never left. We were way, way, way up northwest in Maine. Recently.
Well, along the international boundary.
Right, right. And we came upon a ploy festival, P-L-O-Y-E, which is an Acadian specialty which is very ethnic, but who the heck has ever heard of a ploy? It's like a giant crumpet.
Huh. And, well, it's a buckwheat pancake.
Right. And they're crazy about them there. And every little cafe you go into, you get ploys for breakfast or lunch.
Well, I've just noticed that in Seattle. We've got, where we have more chain restaurants, we also have a lot of very good new Asian restaurants that are funky and family, and whether they're Korean or Filipino or Japanese, you step into them and they have that all the characteristics you're talking about in one of these multi-generation, venerable places that you'd find in some little town in the Midwest. It's connected to the community. It represents what the community is all about. And it's served with a kind of a passion in a community, convivial kind of way.
And when you think about it, that's the history of restaurants in America from the beginning. I mean, we've always been a nation of immigrants. And, you know, American food, there's virtually no food in this country, except for maybe some Native American dishes that are purely American. Everything has roots elsewhere.
We're diverse, we can celebrate it, and we can eat it. I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're eating the ethnic diversity of the United States and celebrating road food with the gurus of road food, Jane and Michael Stern. Jane and Michael, thanks so much. It's always fun to talk to you.
Take care, Rick.
Bye, Rick.
Hello, cat. I just got back, and I'm looking for that place they call the Chicken Shack. They say it's fine as wine, and it's really on a ball. No windows, no doors, it's just a hole in the wall. Did you say it was located down by the creek, where you can get a whole gob of good things to eat? All good parts of the chicken once more is a cinch. You can even get the last part that went over the fence.
You can interact with Jane and Michael Stern and their community of online road food fans at roadfood.com. From time to time, listeners send us a haiku poem they've written about their travels. Many of them lately have also been about the places they call home. Here's a haiku road trip with some of our favorites.
Phil Lefebvre from Buffalo, New York, explains that his city has more than one culinary specialty. In this haiku, he sends us, not just chicken wings, beef on weck in Buffalo. What the heck's a weck? Mark Carmichael from Homer Glen, Illinois, discovered an island in Lake Michigan that was free of the usual tourist scene. No fudge shops live on Beaver Island, Michigan, just sweet indolence. Jane Palestini of Clive, Iowa, sends us a pair of haiku about her favorite city in Pennsylvania. Philadelphia, next. We hope to return there once our house is sold. Home of Liberty, Betsy Ross in Boathouse Row. Pretzels? Cheesesteaks. Yum! While Kathy Smith Whitman from Normal, Illinois, shares this pair of summer haiku, describing what she calls quaint American summertime customs. Midwest motocross. Dust sweat face in July heat. U.S. pastoral. Smooth peanut butter, root beer float, or pumpkin pie. Foreign tourists gag.
Next, have your passport ready for the border control as we check out the back road scene in Canada's British Columbia. 877-333-7425. That's our number. It's Travel with Rick Steves.